on House Bill 5028. Committee members, we have full committee scheduled to start here at 10 o'clock. So we'll be closing this committee at 9:45 to give the full folks some time to set the room up. And just in case we get rushed towards the end, I'd like to let the committee know that this is Megan Jensen's last day sitting in the navigator's chair over there, keeping us all straightened out. And just to thank Megan for the great service. We really appreciate you helping us out and making this all work. And that next week's schedule has been distributed.
Oh, here it is.
Will be distributed. So that you can have your own personal schedules updated. And with that, Mr. Bender, would you please take us through House Bill 5028?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 5028 is the capital construction bill for higher education. You had a public hearing on this bill on March 31st, I believe it was. And as you may recall, there's a separate bill for the capital construction projects of higher ed, separate from their operating budget bill, because of constitutional requirements that the bills be drafted in this manner. We have is spoken to the subcommittee chair, and the work plan for the subcommittee this morning is to do the following. It is to review the capital projects that were presented in the governor's budget at the public hearing and to make decisions on those projects, and then to hear from the department about additional projects that are being proposed in the governor's revised budget. These additional projects would all require lottery bond financing, and the decisions as to whether lottery bonds will be available and to what extent they'll be available are still being worked out. So what we would ask is that you hear about these additional projects, though not make any decisions on those at today. You'll be holding on to this bill and coming back to it at some future time to make those final decisions and to move the bill on to full committee. But there are a number of materials that have been distributed to you. Most of these materials that start with a pile with the Attorney General's notice from the Attorney General to the the Chancellor. We'll be looking at those later. I would ask you now just to look at this one page. It's actually two-sided, so two-page memo from me to the subcommittee dated today. This memo contains the LFO recommendations on the projects that were presented to you in public hearing and that we're asking you to make decisions on today. The form of the memo shows or discusses changes from the governor's budget. And I'd like to go through those with you, what we are recommending. But if I may ask you just to flip to the second page, to the back, and to look at that table. What this table shows is what projects you would approve and the levels of funding that you would approve them at if you do end up approving the LFO recommendations. So this is what the LFO recommendations are on the projects that were brought before you on March 31st. And I'd like to take a minute to go through quickly and to remind you about how capital projects are financed at OUS. Because these are capital projects, the financing is really very different than the way that we finance operating budgets. So I'd like to talk about those four columns there of the different types of funding that are used to support capital projects.
It's really small print, Steve.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it? I don't know if I have a larger copy. The first fund source that is used to support capital projects in higher education is general fund. And general fund, as you can see in this recommendation, as we'll go through, is there's a recommendation of $11,519,853 of general fund. All of this general fund would be used for one purpose or one item there, and that is academic modernization, capital repair, deferred maintenance, and code and safety compliance. Unlike the projects that you see listed below under Oregon State University, Portland State, Southern Oregon University, and University of Oregon, where these are all specifically identified projects, the funds in general fund that go to academic modernization and capital repair are distributed to all seven campuses and are used to address issues of repairing facilities that have come into disrepair and modernizing facilities. The modernization would be putting in, for example, getting access, online access into classroom facilities, just to address modern instructional methods. Also to deal with code and safety compliance. Under this, under the LFO recommendation, there would be $11.5 million of general fund that would be used for these purposes and that would be distributed to the seven campuses. The next source of funding are the Article 11G bonds. The Article 11G bonds are bonds that the are general obligation bonds of the state, and the state pays the debt service on these bonds. So these are state-paid bonds. One element of Article 11G of the Constitution, which authorizes these bonds and gives them their name, is that Article 11G requires that for every dollar in bond that's issued, there be a dollar of general fund issued at the same time, not issued, appropriated at the same time. So Article 11G bonds require a dollar-for-dollar match. You can see here that the recommendation is for, again, $11,519,853 of Article 11G bonds to match the general fund appropriation amount. So the total Article 11G bonds would be about $11.5 million under the LFO recommendation. Article 11F1 bonds, which you can see there are many projects that use this source of finance, are quite different than Article 11G bonds in the following sense. The state does not, in the future, need to appropriate general fund for the debt service on these bonds. These bonds are general obligation bonds, so potentially, if other sources of funding were not to be available, we would have to use general fund. But for each of these bond projects, there is an identified source of revenue to repay the debt service, or to pay the debt service on the bonds over the 20 or 30 year life of the bonds for each project. The debts, the sources of funds that are used for the Article 11F bonds are of two major categories. One category is that for the Article 11F1 bonds that are being used to finance new or to construct or to rehabilitate or to make additions to student facilities, student activity facilities, there is a student building fee that is paid by all students enrolled in the Oregon University system, and that in statute, that money is set aside to pay the debt service on Article 11F1 bonds that are issued for those particular projects. So, for example, some of the projects in this particular case where when you see Article 11F1 bonds and you're wondering, well, who's going to pay the debt service on that or how it's going to be paid, if you look under and this list, Section 2, Oregon State University, if you look at 2B, the Memorial Union Remodel, Phase 1, this is a project to that includes a remodel of the Memorial Union, and this is a facility that's financed by student activity fees, and the debt service on the $5.5 million of Article 11F1 bonds will be paid from student building fee revenues. There are other ones that are like that. For example, under the Portland State University, 3A, the Smith Memorial Student Union Renovation. This is a very similar project for Portland State's student union. And there, this is a $7 million project financed by these Article 11 F1 bonds, and the bonds will be paid by the student building fee. The other major category or source of Article 11 F1 bond repayments are the fees that are generated from the various auxiliary enterprises of higher education. The auxiliary enterprises include housing services, dining services, student health services, parking services. All of these auxiliaries are financed without any general fund support for their operations. The finance for these facilities come from fees that are charged in that, you know, to run that specific operation. And higher ed operates all of these without state general fund support. And in the operating budget, the expenditures are not even limited. These are non-limited. So the amount that is spent on housing, for example, is non-limited. The debt service on a bond that's being issued to construct a housing facility or to renovate a housing facility is paid out of the institution's housing budget. So the housing fees that are being generated are used to pay the debt service. So for example, if you look at a situation, I'm just trying to find one here, if you look under subsection 5 on this list, University of Oregon, you can see D is a residence hall restoration phase one project. This is a plan to spend $2 million on a residence hall renovation. Though the debt service on those $2 million in bonds will be paid from the University of Oregon's housing budget, which receives no general fund and is financed by fees to students who reside in those housing facilities. In total, the projects here would total up to $243 million in Article 11 F1 bonds. The final category, the other revenues, include a number of sources of funds. Primarily, though, they would include donations. So when people donate funds to build a new facility, those amounts are shown here as other revenues. There are also, in some cases, they may be coming through contracts or grants. These are other sources of funds that are used to construct facilities. And these represent components that are paid out on a cash basis and do not generate debt service costs in the future. To note, fundamentally, the LFO recommendation that you see here is the governor's recommendation. We're recommending the governor's recommendation with very small modifications to that, which are shown in numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4, which I can discuss, that bring about the numbers that you see here in the table in the back. But just in some comparison, just to give you some comparison, in the 01-03 capital budget for the biennium that ended a few days ago, the total general fund amount there was about $16 million. So you can see this new budget has a drop in general fund from $16 million to about $11.5 million. For Article 11G bonds, these are the bonds where the state has an obligation to pay the debt service out of the general fund, you can see the total is $11.5 million. This is a very large reduction from last biennium's state-supported debt service. Last biennium, the state issued both Article 11G bonds and lottery bonds for projects, both of which require the state to pay the debt service, and that totaled about $115 million. So the state-supported debt is down from $115 million to about $11 million. So this budget is much significantly reduced from last biennium in terms of the amount that the state will finance from general fund and in the future for debt service.
Mr. Bender, why is that lower? Was debt paid off?
No. The debt for those $115 million in projects are now, the state is only now actually starting to pay for those, the debt service on that. And that would not show up here. That shows up in the debt service budget, which is different for higher ed. What happened was last session, there were a large number of projects that were approved, and they did total $115 million. The state will be paying debt service on those projects generally for between 15 and 30 years, depending upon the bonds that were issued. What this is showing is that this particular budget will not add very much in terms of state debt to the amount that is already outstanding. In fact, we estimate or project that the $11.5 million, in the effect of these $11.5 million in Article 11G bonds would be the debt service on those next biennium would be approximately a little less than $1.5 million.
Mr. Bender, in terms of the total amount of debt service that the general fund pays for the Department of Higher Education, can you give us the numbers that were in the 01-03 budget and are projected in the 03-05 and 05-07 budgets, excluding these projects? Do you have that information?
I have most of that. I definitely have the 01-03. In 01-03, the total state-supported debt service was $22.1 million for the Department of Higher Ed.
In the biennium?
Yes.
Okay. And you mean the payment?
The debt service, right.
Yeah.
So all this represents are debt service on bonds that were issued before the 2001 session. And then in 2001-03, the debt service was $22.1 million.
What's the total bonding?
Not sure about it.
I didn't see it in this book here, unless I'm not looking.
I did have that number. I don't know if anyone
Do
here.
Do we have anyone from the chancellor's office that has that information? Or wants to take a reasonable stab at it?
Let me see if I, I think I do have that information here, actually.
Mr. McGee, are you wanting to weigh in on this one?
I have the number, actually. The amount of Article 11G bonds that are outstanding was, earlier in the spring, $123.5 million. So this would add to that total $11.5 million, and some of these bonds may be retired during the course of this biennium. Probably there's some series that would be retired.
How much?
That
anybody know? He's checking, okay.
So would the committee be correct in assuming then that because there will be some retiring going on and theoretically some additions going on, and then we have also the issue of the increased bonding in 01-03 being becoming part of the 03-05 indebtedness to the general fund, you got any idea much 03-05 will rise, excluding the 11.5 on this list?
We know that the 03-05 debt service is up to $30.5 million. That's a 38% increase, and that is entirely due to the $115 million in projects that were already approved. The $11.5 million that you're considering here will have no effect on debt service this biennium, because Article 11G bonds, when you issue them, they do not have an impact on the state's debt service general fund for debt service requirements until the following biennium. So the 11.5 would have an impact in the 05-07 biennium of about $1.5 million.
Yeah. So would a fair estimate for the 05-07 indebtedness then be about $32 million?
About, though it would probably be slightly less than that because some bonds we would expect to be retired.
Okay. So we could we use just $30 million and be in the ballpark?
Oh yeah, that would be in the ballpark.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bates, you're wrinkling your
finger. Oh, I shouldn't. I'm just trying to remember stuff from March. I'm probably remembering it wrong, so I'll go back and search a little.
Okay. Any more questions, Senator Masur? Mr. Bender, please proceed.
If I may ask you to turn back to the front page or side of this recommendation, I would like to discuss what the LFO recommendations are. Our first recommendation is to approve the projects that the governor proposed in his printed budget and the changes that were included by the governor as technical adjustments at the public hearing back in March. The governor proposed a number of technical adjustments at that public hearing, and we are concurring with those. And they are as follows. For the academic modernization, capital repair, deferred maintenance, code, and safety compliance, to add $20 million in Article 11 F1 bonds and $10 million in other revenues, including federal funds, expenditure limitation. So this is an additional $30 million. None of these bonds will be paid by general fund. These would be paid by the auxiliary sources of funding that we talked about earlier. And this is included as a technical adjustment because it was not included at the time the governor presented the budget because they needed a little bit more information at that time, which they didn't get until prior to the public hearing. This would retain funding from these sources for academic modernization and repair at the levels, roughly the levels of the prior biennium. So without this adjustment, there would be a sharp decline from the prior biennium levels. The second technical adjustment, which is shown here in B, is to provide $12 million in total, $6 million in bonding authority for the Article 11 F1 bonds, and $6 million in the form of contributions and other items, other revenues, including federal funds, for system-wide small capital projects. So these are projects that are always less than $1 million in cost and that are not specifically identified here because in many cases they're still under review and as the funding, since the funding for these often comes in the form of other revenues. This gives the department flexibility to finance these small capital projects as needs and funding become available. And this, again, would provide funding at approximately the levels that were funded in the 01-03 biennium for the same purpose. The third technical adjustment that the governor is recommending and that we also recommend is specific project C. It's the Oregon State University College of Veterinary Medicine addition. This was a project that was funded at slightly less than $8 million last biennium. The institution has been able to raise an additional $2.2 million in donations to help provide equipment for the new facility. And both the governor and LFO recommend that you establish a $2.2 million other revenues, including federal funds, expenditure limitation for this project. And finally, D, Portland State University's Helen Gordon Child Development Center Rehabilitation Phase 2 project, which is one of these student building fee funded projects, was in the governor's budget at $2.5 million to be paid back by Article 11 F1 bonds. On further review, that project will need an additional $1 million limitation for a total of $3.5 million. So LFO recommends that technical adjustment as well.
Committee members, are there any questions or discussion for Mr. Bender on these technical adjustments? Is there anyone that objects to any of them? Chair would accept a motion to approve the LFO recommendation on the technical adjustments to projects in the governor's printed budget.
So moved.
We have the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. Mr. Bender.
LFO's second recommendation is that the subcommittee reduce general fund to academic modernization, capital repair, deferred maintenance, code and safety compliance by $1 million from the level in the governor's budget, and reduce the Article 11G bonds expenditure limitation for the same line item by $1 million to conform with a funding reduction in the co-chair's budget. When you look at the $11 million on the back page, what was in the governor's proposal was $12,519,853 in general fund and Article 11G bonds. As part of their effort to rebalance the state budget, the co-chairs do have a $1 million reduction in this general fund line item in this budget, and LFO recommends that to conform with that budget rebalance.
Questions or comments on the LFO recommendation to the general fund reduction?
Representative Bates. I noticed there's a $10 million other revenues in here, and is that going to make up for some of the lost funding here? I'm always concerned that these are the projects that keep the campuses up to speed. I know as an example that Southern just got hit with a $500,000 bill for getting asbestos out of a building where they can't use it. It's it was built, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. So they have unexpected costs, and they have costs to have to maintain the buildings. Will some of this be made up with other revenues here, or was that already in the budget, and this is just a $2 million hit to them?
Well, I think this is basically a $2 million reduction. The $10 million was added to the budget, or the governor added that in public hearing, and this would be in the form of contributions and other sources of funds that could be used for this project, for those types of projects. But this is a $2 million reduction from the governor's recommended budget. In the governor's revised budget, he actually had an even larger reduction in general fund than the $1 million that was in the co-chair. So when the governor came out with his revised budget, I think it was like a $1.8 million reduction.
Further question?
Yeah, I'm going to vote for the budget, but I just want to point out that when we do these kind of things, we're probably delaying things we're going to have to fix later anyway, and it's cost us more later than now. But considering the situation we're in the state, I understand the situation. I just feel very uncomfortable doing this, but I will vote for the budget.
I think that all of us recognize the issues of ongoing maintenance and capital repair and modernization issues in the campus. And again, I really appreciate your comment about the fiscal situation that we find ourselves in. And I think that the only thing that we can fall back on here is that we did substantially increase in the biennium that just ended our investment in trying to bring this into a more current frame that it had been in. But, you know, I think that once again we need to recognize that we aren't doing this willingly, that we're trying to make the economies that we can in the best way that we can. And given any other way to do this, we would be going in a different direction. Is there any more discussion on the LFO recommendation? Is there anyone objecting to it? The chair would accept a motion then that we accept the LFO recommendation to the general fund reduction.
So moved.
Senator Gordley's made the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. Mr. Bender.
Recommendation 3 does not involve any dollars. We have received information from OUS since the public hearing and since the description of projects was put together and submitted to you, which you find in your three-ring binder, that they omitted part of the description of the Oregon State University Research Stadium expansion project. We just ask you to note that the project will include a parking facility in the scope of the project that had not been indicated earlier. There are no changes in the dollar amounts noted in the bill. So we'd like you to note that, and if you have any concerns about that, this would be time to bring those up.
Well, I think that there will be a lot of Beaver fans that are happy to know that they're going to have a place to park when they come to Oregon State University. Is there any questions or discussions for
Mr. Bender? Just a quick comment. It's only right since Onsen Stadium had its roof raised that we also do it for the Beavers.
Well, it's actually nice to have extra parking for U of O fans to come over to watch the Beavers get whacked again.
Madam Chairman, I'm considering it being a no vote. Please get a comment.
Oh, no. Chair would accept a motion to accept the LFO recommendation on the Oregon State University Research Stadium expansion and leave the animal comments out of it.
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
We have a motion. Is there discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair, this Viking will not make any further comments.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion is carried. Mr. Bender.
On the final recommendation we would ask you to consider on this budget today is to make a change in the approval for a project that you originally approved, or that the legislature originally approved in 1999. When a capital project is approved, it is valid for 6 years to be completed. And in 1999, you approved a project that would to be financed by about $1.4 million in Article 11G bonds and approximately $1.4 million in other revenues for the Portland State University Millar Library Research Center project. That project is pretty much complete, but it turns out that there are additional donations available for this project beyond the $1.4 million that was approved initially. And the university and the system are requesting your permission for the university to spend the additional donations that they have received on behalf of this project on that particular project. This LFO is recommending approval as well. We recommend that the subcommittee increase the other funds, other revenues, including federal funds expenditure limitation established for the Department of Higher Education, and this is the legal reference, for the Portland State University Millar Library Research Center project by Section 34G, Chapter 890, Oregon Laws 1999, by $206,766. That's the amount of these additional donations, to allow the additional donations received on behalf of the project to be spent on the project. Because these are all donations and not debt, this won't have any increase in debt service costs. These will just allow them to spend their donations on this project.
Senator Mazurday.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Steve, I'm curious, do we have information as to what these monies go for? I assume this is a common practice, and is this to enhance, add something to the construction or put equipment in the building when it's done? Or
I don't have all the details on that. I don't know if there's anyone here who has to do that.
Please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for record, my name is Bob Simonton, Director of Capital Construction. The money for the Millar Library was a federal grant. It was restricted to cataloging, so the funds will be used for that process in the library.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Further questions or comments on the LFO recommendation? Chair would accept a motion to accept the LFO recommendation relating to Portland State University Millar Library Research Center project.
So moved.
Senator Gordley's made the motion. Is there discussion on the motion? Mm-hmm. Objection to the motion? Mm-hmm. Without objection, the motion is carried. Mr. Bender.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. We have asked the department to make some presentations to you now on additional projects that are included in the governor's revised budget that would eventually be included in this bill if you do approve them. So they are prepared to do that, and you have a set of materials that they will be using that have been distributed to you.
Committee members, I would also add that if anyone has any questions about any of the projects on the capital construction list, that this would be an appropriate time to ask those questions. Mr. Jarvis.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and in the interest of your reduced time, I'll omit introductory remarks, and if we may lead with the two projects for which we've invited witnesses to come here and present to you today. The first of those is a lottery bond and private funds match proposal for our ongoing engineering and high technology education initiative. It drives to both the 2X doubling element and the top-tier engineering education quality elements. The projects you have in front of you have been thoroughly reviewed by the campuses and the OUS and have been further reviewed.
Mr. Chancellor, are you referencing any of the documents that we have in front of us right now?
Yes, I should be, if Mr. Cairns can point out to you which they are.
One's entitled Engineering and Technology Industry Council Capital Investment Proposal by NGI 1-2020. We hope fund has a table with the proposed investment.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Forgive us, Madam Chair. Paper RS, of course, in higher education. The proposal has also been approved for submission to you by the Executive Committee of the State Board of Higher Education. So to present it, allow me to introduce Mr. Wally Rhines, Chairman and CEO of Mentor Graphics, who is the Chair of the Engineering Technology Industry Council.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, committee members. For the record, I'm Walden Rhines, and my part-time job is as Chairman and CEO of Mentor Graphics, and my other job is as Chair of the Engineering and Technology Industry Council. ETIC is established or was established by the legislature in 1996 with the goal of dramatically upgrading engineering and computer science and technology education in the state. We serve as an advisor to the chancellor, and we're representing a number of the leading businesses throughout the state, principally those that either use or have as their mainstay engineering and technology and computer science capabilities. Now, the problem that ETIC addresses is the fact that our businesses in the state end up hiring about 80% of the engineering and computer science graduates that we hire from out of state as opposed to in-state. Not because we would not prefer to hire them in-state, and not because we're not satisfied with the quality of education overall, but because of availability.
May I interrupt for
yes.
just one moment? I think that you would have to be living way up the back of one of the canyons down in my district not to know that the electronics industry in the state's undergone a real transformation over the last couple of years. Does that 80% number still hold true in the diminished aspects that the industry finds itself in?
This is the last year for which there are complete records, which is 2001. Obviously, 2002 was an extremely difficult year for the electronics industry. There was, in fact, net no hiring and, in fact, a negative amount of hiring. But if you look at it over any broader period, the 10-year period, you look at it even over the bubble and the first year of the downturn, there is net hiring. And in that net hiring, the statistics favor hiring out of state versus in state simply through availability. Now, currently, high technology is not adding to employment in the state, but it will, and the recovery, which is the recession, which is the longest in the history of the electronics industry by more than a factor of 1.5, certainly shows strong signs of bottoming and moving into a period where the recovery starts. Companies like my own are, in fact, judiciously hiring again and have been adding people during the past year. Not a total recovery, not a boom, but the problem is that when we do start hiring, they're critical skills, they're hard to get, and the state needs to do whatever it can to prepare the residents of this state to compete for those jobs.
If I might just ask another question and interrupt you further. The we also have received information in a number of different committees that the nature of your industry is changing greatly, and that the manufacturing aspects that had fueled the growth in the industry in the state, that capacity was moving offshore, and that the there were other aspects of the industry that were also moving on offshore, and that it didn't look in the future like we would expect those capacities to return to this country or the state. And so I would ask you, just based on your experience in the industry, how you see the need for engineers evolving, given that, those capacities don't look like where the industry will be expanding.
First of all, Madam Chair, the requirements for engineering graduates by the businesses, both in this state and nationwide, will continue to grow at a far faster rate than the economy. The thing you're pointing out is that we have a world economy, that students and trained professionals all over the world compete for the jobs all over the world, and so increasingly, to compete in that market, people have to be well-educated and prepared. Now, what about the industries in the state? Manufacturing jobs, net for the United States, have been moving offshore, principally to China, but if we were here 15 years ago, it would have been Japan and so on. It moves around the world. That's not to say that the highly skilled jobs will move. Intel is not going to be moving wafer fabs to China anytime soon. The skilled jobs that Hewlett-Packard carries in Corvallis and other places are jobs that require direct interaction, require design. Now, all of our companies use offshore resources. We principally use them for things that can easily be delegated, such as product maintenance and other enhancements. We try to do our principal innovative product development in an area where people can work together, meaning either where our headquarters are or where our major installations are. That'll continue as long as we can hire those resources. The scare we got in the year 2000 was that there, under no conditions could we hire the resources we need, and in order to continue to grow the business, people increasingly went offshore. I think as we go forward, you will see continued hiring offshore, but you'll see continued hiring in the United States and in Oregon as long as we prepare graduates who can handle those jobs.
Thank you.
The great thing about ETIC is that when you hire a faculty member, that faculty member in engineering or computer science typically generates research contracts. As we add students, they generate additional tuition. So ETIC has a lasting benefit. It's not something where when we stop it, the benefit goes away. Those faculty members generally become self-funding in 2 to 3 years. And lastly, for the capital portion of this proposal, there is $18 of private match associated with every $20 of the capital appropriation. The goal of ETIC is to double the output of our schools in engineering and computer science, and to do that in roughly a 10-year period completed in 2009. The other part is to establish nationally ranked programs at each of the 8 schools to build the reputation and desirability of getting degrees from Oregon schools. And lastly, the side benefit is that it drives economic growth, job creation, and allows us to create jobs for Oregonians. There are 8 campuses affected. All of the major campuses that provide engineering and computer science programs in the state, and we've allocated the funding for new facilities, improvements to facilities, laboratory equipment, as well as some other miscellaneous items. If you look at it by school, we have reviewed specific capital programs and their impact, particularly on those goals of doubling the output of engineers and dramatically increasing the national reputation of the schools in specific areas. There's $20 million total. That'll be matched with at least $18 million of private funds. I would direct you to the previous history of ETIC, which is one where in every biennium we have dramatically exceeded our projected private match that has been put into the budget in each case. So we're hopeful that we can exceed this one as well.
Do you have any information for the committee that gives the amount of money that this process has invested in ETIC to this point?
No, but I can do that pretty quickly.
Madam Chair, for the record, Grant and Karen, and OUS, to date you have put $40 million in public funds.
You coward.
Your $40 million in public funds since ETIC was established under Senate Bill 504 has attracted $67 million in industry match through December 31, 2002. So for $40 million, you've received leverage $67 million. So.
Okay, and the $40 million, if you could, I would really be happy if you'd just sit down here.
Well, I'm watching the clock here.
Okay, when the $40 million investment, has that all been in the last biennium or?
No, ma'am. That has been since Senate Bill 504 was established in the 1997 session. So that would have been 97, 99, 99, 01, 01, 03. So there's been three separate appropriations, not equal, to the 2X and Engineering Excellence Top Tier Engineering and Technology Initiative. So there's been three appropriations.
Yeah, one more question just for the clarification of the committee. When we received information during the hearing on the OUS budget, there were items in your cell funding that you do that relate to training of engineering and top-tier engineering schools. Is that this money, or is this additional money?
This would be an additional, Madam Chair. That underwrites the College of Engineering, the computer science departments, and the faculty in the ongoing educational mission for those disciplines. This is the incremental addition, which achieves the doubling of the output and enhancing the quality.
Then I would request some homework for you. Could you please prepare for the committee a display that would show the investment into the engineering arena from all sources in the Oregon University system? And if you could go back three bienniums so that the committee could get the historical context of the funding levels here, I think that would be very valuable information.
Easily done. Be happy to present.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
Finally, just concluding, the capital funds complement the operating funds by providing the facilities required to create and grow those programs. In the new facilities category, the largest share is at Portland State, where we have a variety of centers of excellence and no place for them to expand, and at OGI, where the Branson Creek facility will allow us to merge the electrical engineering computer science departments and create laboratories and classrooms. In the improvement category, major improvements at Oregon State University, principally in refurbishment and upgrading of facilities, and at the University of Oregon, where we focused on capital equipment for materials characterization in an area where we built excellence over the past few years. And then in the laboratory equipment, a combination, Oregon State and the University of Oregon, as well as some other miscellaneous equipment. That's all I have.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The second project we'd like to present to you today is the Signature Research Initiative developed by the Oregon Council on Knowledge and Economic Development. This has led to the proposal for the establishment of a major multi-campus center in multi-scale materials and devices. And to describe that to you, let me call upon representatives of the three research universities: Richard Linton, University of Oregon Vice President for Research; Ron Adams, Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University; and Michael Driscoll, Vice Provost at Portland State University. They will take it from here.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Talk to us again.
Please. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Ron Adams, Dean of Engineering at Oregon State University. You have heard about this initiative before. It was presented to you as a description of Senate Bill 360 to create a new Signature Research Center for Oregon. And the center, as you heard, is a collaborative effort involving Oregon State University, University of Oregon, Portland State University, and the Oregon Graduate Institute at OHSU. In addition to that, we're also collaborating with the Patel Memorial Institute through the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. To refresh your memory about multi-scale materials and devices, I have with me today a device that many of you purchase on a periodic basis. This is an HP ink cartridge, and you think, I'm sure, that you're just buying ink, but it turns out you're also buying a very high technology device. And if you can see in the front of this, there's a shiny part. Mm-hmm. It's about the size of that flag pin, Senator Morgan, Representative Morgan, on your lapel. That device contains microchannels that produce the tiny little droplets that create the pretty pictures that you print when you use an HP printhead. Also, to illustrate that this is an indigenous industry here in Oregon, this device, all the R&D, the manufacturing process development, is all done in Corvallis. And that facility employs about 4,000 people. To Wally's earlier point, the manufacturing of this device is predominantly done offshore, and it's been done that way for a number of years, beginning with the early versions of the product. But the R&D, the intellectual capital behind the product, still resides here in Oregon. And again, 4,000 relatively high-paying jobs are associated with that operation. That one company, along with Intel, Xerox, FEI, ESI, and others, are also collaborating with us, and they are pulling together what they are calling the Micro to Nano Collaborative, because what this Signature Research Center is about is putting nanotechnology to work in micro devices, again, like the HP printhead. The devices that we have in mind can be used to sense biochemical threats to homeland security. They could be used to create devices that would enable you to more effectively and at a lower cost heat and cool your home. And they could also be used to create devices that would power your laptop for days as opposed to hours, as current technology provides. As you heard, it's a collaborative effort, and just 2 days ago, our three institutions signed a memorandum of understanding that says we will work together as three institutions to make the MMD succeed. The project description that you will see is really involves the capital project, but in addition to that, as you may recall from Senate Bill 360, there is also an operating budget associated with the center. And that operating budget request was $10 million. The total capital request is $20 million. The part of the capital request involving Oregon State University is to create a facility which we are calling the Microproducts Breakthrough Institute. Now, this is a collaboration involving Oregon State University and the Pacific Northwest National Labs, focused on developing devices and then also moving those devices towards commercialization. So it has a definite interest and impact on building new companies in Oregon.
May I interrupt just for a moment? Ms. Bender, the $20 million for capital projects, is the proposal on the table is to fund that with lottery-backed bonds?
That, I believe, is half lottery-backed bonds and half Article 11G bonds.
Okay. And then What is the proposal for the operating side?
The original proposal was for $10 million in general fund. The government is now supporting only $1 million in general fund, with the understanding that the institutions would raise and redirect a total of $9 million of their other resources into this project.
And do we have any information on the ongoing need for support that this project will have?
I have not received any indication that this would be part of a roll-up. The capital projects would generate debt service costs in terms of both future general fund for the Article 11G bonds and future lottery costs in terms of the lottery.
And what about the operating costs?
The operating costs, perhaps Mr. McGee will mention that, since we have not heard otherwise, or I have not, I'm not aware of otherwise, these would become part of generally part of the agency's base budget, be it an increase of $1 million and $9 million of other funds in that budget on an ongoing basis with inflation and other types of changes that we as we adjust the base budget from one by another.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Just briefly, as you can see, what we have in mind at Oregon State is, again, is to develop that laboratory. It involves 30,000 square feet of space, and it will house this collaborative effort involving Oregon State and PNNL. It will also provide services to the entire collaborative, entire collaborative signature research effort. Currently, that facility will be temporarily housed in HP's Building 11 in Corvallis, and many of you have heard that HP has gifted use of that building to OUS for the purpose of supporting the Signature Research Center. This investment is aimed at creating a tremendous amount of leverage. We're estimating that over the next decade, it will produce about $400 million in federal grants and contracts, as well as private grants and contracts in this area we call MMD. We also think that this will enable us to spin out as many as 15 new companies in the next decade that could employ as many as 2,000 Oregonians. And so there's not only an impact in terms of developing the economy for the future, but also the $400 million that we expect to receive in grants and contracts will also have an added benefit to the economy as well. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Rich Linton, Vice President for Research at the University of Oregon. I see we've got maybe 3 minutes left on your original time scale, so I'll try to keep this very brief, and certainly you've got some written testimony there that highlights some of the key points. Let me just highlight a few things. First is to reiterate the collaborative effort. I think that's unprecedented in terms of the collaboration between the institutions that are represented at the table. I think we have a unique niche for this work. It combines strengths. It's not building from ground zero. It combines strengths at the institutions in areas of physical sciences and engineering and complementary efforts at the three campuses. It really builds on prior state investment. And an example at our institution, where we're a leading institution in the state in nanoscience, 20 years ago, you put in some funds, seed funds, for a center of excellence in material science. We have the Material Science Institute. 20 years later, that's generating about $10 million a year in sponsored research, primarily from the federal government, and that relates to an initial state investment of a couple hundred thousand dollars. So every year it's returning 40-fold in what the state initially invested. That kind of strength is what we're trying to build on in this initiative. And so we're moving it now to the next level, where the ETIC investments you just heard about, some of the earlier investments of the state in centers of excellence, lead us to the point where we can be competitive in a niche area which combines nanoscience and engineering sciences at the three campuses, as well as a strong partnership with industry. In terms of the UO specifically, we are looking at facilities that would do essentially two things. One is to make materials at a scale that is in the nanometer dimension. And to get a sense of that, a nanometer, if you put a football into a nanometer scale, you could line up 100 billion footballs along the length of a football field. So incredibly tiny materials and devices. So we will be developing facilities to make materials at that scale and to characterize the chemistry and physics of those materials at that scale. So we have what we call a nano foundry, a way to make small things, and a nano characterization center, a way to measure their properties. And that will be housed in what we call a multi-scale materials and devices laboratory, and it would be part of a broader integrative science facility development at our campus, where we have really established strengths in the physical sciences, really the leading academic institution in the state in areas of physics and chemistry. And then finally, in terms of the economic impact, we have a detailed business plan that Ron alluded to. You've seen some of the data earlier. We will be able to leverage this state capital investment over the next decade by 10 to 20 fold. And so we're looking primarily at federal support that will be generating collectively hundreds of millions of dollars over the next decade. But if we don't act now, the final point really is that we need to act now to establish the ability of Oregon to move ahead in this competitive niche for economic development. So a modest investment now will create, I think, tremendous return over the decade. And that's the base of the argument why OCHED has supported it, why it's in the governor's budget. It's a true economic development initiative, and it's the way to do economic development if we're trying to combine university research with industrial strength in the state.
The gentlemen, we have reached the end of the time that we have, and we're going to need to give setup time because full Ways and Means will be meeting in this room at 10 o'clock. But what I would like to do is to schedule another public hearing on this next Tuesday, the 8th, and we have only one short bill on our agenda, which I don't think is going to take very much time. But I think that the committee would be very interested in continuing this discussion. And we obviously haven't gotten all of the information that you want us to have so that we're aware of what's going on. So with your kind permission, I will just draw the line here and then open another work session on Tuesday the 8th and invite you to come back and talk to us again at that time. Is there any further business that the committee members have? With no further business before the committee, we'll close the work session on House Bill 5028 and adjourn the meeting, and we will reconvene on Tuesday morning at 8:30.